Well, let me begin by addressing the elephant in the room, the elephant being me. For those of you who did not get the memo, our speaker for this weekend, Jenny Black, her flight was canceled this morning, and so she found another flight. I talked to her this morning, and we'd had kind of a little planes, trains, and automobiles conversation, but she's coming from St. Louis, so that wasn't going to work. So she'll be actually landing while we're talking here tonight, and she'll be here tomorrow for the workshop. So everybody who's coming tomorrow, she will be here, but tonight, I am so sorry, you have to listen to me. So I'm going to turn around for a second, and anyone who wants to leave, no. We figured, though, as I talked to her, that it was still important to deliver tonight's talk, because tomorrow is going to be building off a lot of what we're talking about tonight, which is an understanding of what media trauma is. And so tonight we're going to be defining what happens when we are interacting with media, and then tomorrow we're going to talk a little bit more about what we can do to identify specifically what's happening to us and how to respond to this. And so if you decide tonight that, oh man, this barely scraped the surface and I'd really like to come tomorrow, you can still sign up. Don't ask Debbie about that because she's not going to like me for saying that, but if you want to come, talk to me and we'll find a spot for you. But we're here to talk about the effects of media on our lives. We use the term media because it's more than just social media. It's more than just smartphones. It's how information is delivered through current technology that is creating a dehumanizing experience for us. And so this includes everything. It includes 24-hour news. It includes apps. It includes tablets. Our connection to screens and our connection to the internet has greatly altered the way that we live life and even the way that we understand what our life is about. And so I want to start with this quote. It says, when a population becomes distracted by trivia, when a cultural life is redefined as a perpetual round of entertainments, when serious public conversation becomes a form of baby talk, when in short a people become an audience and their public business a vaudeville act, then a nation finds itself at risk. Culture death is a clear possibility. And the clearest way to see through a culture is to attend to its tools for conversation. This is from a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman. Now, I put that up there because I think it's interesting. This book was written in 1985, and the media that he's talking about here is actually television. And so that whole book is basically about how television is going to reshape our culture, how it's going to affect the way that we even see and understand truth. And so before, though, you dismiss this as just another doomsdayer from another era, just another person who is kind of shaking their fists at a cloud, this is an amazing book. It's amazing to read this and actually see how many of the things called out in 1985 have come true, how many things he saw beforehand, including, it's amazing, he's like, we will just start electing celebrities as our president, because we will have no differentiation between politics and celebrity. And so it's interesting to see. I guess in the 80s, he already had Reagan, so it was easy for him to see that. But it's interesting to see even how some of those things come true. Now, what makes our current issues with media different is just the constancy of it. Right? It's always with us. It is at our fingertips. It is speaking into our life at all times. And so it's different than the TV where you would choose to go and sit down and watch it. We are carrying our media around with us all the time. It is pinging at us, reminding us that it is there, that there is a conversation, that there is something that we might be missing out on. And what this does is it actually kind of shifts us, it disorients us. Now, we don't usually recognize this disorientation in time. We don't feel the unhealthiness that we have as we surf the web or update our Instagram page. But it becomes a little bit more clear when you step back and look at the bigger picture. It becomes a little clearer when you see what is happening to us from a distance, especially when you look through the lens of mental health. And I would say especially in regards to younger people. So with that, here's a graph. Death by suicide, and you can see this is invention of social media. 2012 is about the time that the majority of people began to own a smartphone. 2014 is the point at which most teens got a smartphone, and you can see it just goes up. Suicide is now the leading cause of death among people 15 to 24 in the U.S., Nearly 20% of high school students report serious thoughts of suicide, and 9% have made an attempt to take their lives, according to the National Alliance of Mental Illness. And so again, this is something we can look at and go, something is going on. Here's another one, maybe. This is on percentage with high depression symptoms. You can see that social media has certainly affected young women more than it has young men. The share of U.S. teenagers who have experienced at least one major depressive episode in the past year rose 14.4% in 2018. That's almost double the 2006 rate of 7.9%. And what's interesting about both of these charts is this is pre-pandemic. All right, this is stuff that was happening before we shut down and did all of these things. This was already occurring. This was already what we were dealing with. And so when we look at charts and graphs, these sorts of things, it is evident that something is wrong. But when we start to try to define what that is, a lot of people just go, I don't know. Right? It's hard to draw a direct correlation between media and mental health. And I've read article after article after article, and there's so many of them where sociologists basically just go, we don't really know what's going on. Something's happening, but we can't really put our finger on it, which is really, really helpful to those of us who are raising kids in this world. Thanks, right? That helps us. Now we can fix the problem that no one has any idea what it is. And it leads us to just sort of accept the mental health crisis as something that we have no ability to affect and that we have to basically treat on the other end of through medication, through counseling, through all the things that are great things that we're trying to deal with. But we never really get to the root of the problem. And really, as parents, it just leads us to a certain amount of hopelessness. Just going, let's put them out there. Hope that they don't become one of the percentages. So Jenny Black, she was frustrated by this lack of clarity as well, and she decided to pour herself into figuring out what some of these correlations were, and then putting some terms and some categories to them to help us understand it. That's really what she has been doing for almost the past decade, is trying to give a language to all of this to help us truly understand what's going on so that we can start talking about solutions. That's what we're going to be doing tonight, giving names to things, pointing out what is going on. Tomorrow, really starting to work through what are some of the steps to repair these things. And so I want to start with her TED Talk. We had posted this on the church's site. You may have watched it, you may have not. We're going to watch it again. And this time, pay attention, because I'm going to kind of use some of the talking points that she has here as we move forward. All right, so after watching that, it is clear that I am not Jenny Black. She is charismatic, petite blonde who wears leather pants. I am not. Anybody have idea for Christmas gifts? But we both, I think, share a common realization that we didn't have a healthy relationship with media. For me, this actually came about in a very weird interaction I had with someone a while ago. I met someone at a gathering that I had never met before. It was a friend's gathering. This person was there. And as I shook their hand, I realized, I know where this person works. I know who their friends are. And I even know what vacation they went on. And this is because my friend had posted pictures with this person and all of these different things. But it was a surreal thing to be meeting someone for the first time and realizing you already have enough information about them to have already kind of made some assumptions about them, which is probably another thing that we could deal with. But the issue is that when we meet people, there is a way that that information comes out. There's a way that we, you know, kind of learn about who someone is, and this was kind of very different, right? It's different to see someone's pictures from their vacation and to hear someone explain all of the things that happened. When you hear someone talk about what they did and what their vacation was, you actually kind of enjoy it along with them. When you look at their pictures, you tend to get jealous and maybe have a little bit of that fear of missing out. Why can't I take trips like that? And so that moment with the stranger helped me to see kind of that a direct connection between some things that just didn't seem right. It seemed like It seemed like a weird thing to me meeting someone for the first time that you actually already had all of this information about. And so Jenny uses the story, though of her niece and the inside treats, and she uses that as sort of the grounding idea in her talk. And when she's talking about inside treats here, she's talking about internal validation, identity, well-being, all the things that form our understanding of who we are in the world. And so in some ways, inside treats is almost too trite. This is actually a huge issue of just who we understand ourselves to be. This is the core of how we see ourselves. And so she says social media and technology has ruined and replaced our need for inside treats. This isn't just about kind of getting a piece of candy. What social media does is it replaces the means by which we understand ourselves. And it gives us this synthetic relationship and this targeted news and this endless stream of the next thing. And in all of it, it is forming us as people. It gives us the sense that we have thousands of friends, that we have access to celebrities because we can just directly talk to them, that we're connected to events and circumstances that we really aren't at. And she talked a little bit about this idea of vicarious trauma, that we they get the rush of kind of energy that comes from seeing something happen without the release on the other end. And this is the problem with things that are synthetic. They don't give you the full picture. It feels like the same thing for a moment, but it ends up affecting us very differently. And this is the problem with most synthetic things. They give you a taste of reality, but it's thin. And you might not notice it right away. Right away, you just kind of go, okay, it's not that big of a deal. It feels like we're getting social interaction. It feels like we're engaging with the world in a heightened way. Look at all of the news that we have at our fingertips. But all of this stuff is not working like real relationships do. In the end, as she said, it ends up taking from us rather than actually feeding us. And so she said, it's not just about what is happening in us through all of this, but what is not happening. It isn't just that, again, social media is bad or having internet all the time with you is bad. There's lots of great things about it. But to recognize that when you go to your phone to entertain you or to give you something, there's something else that you are missing out on. Right, when you conduct a relationship on social media, there's another relationship that is not getting your time and attention. And I think the perfect example of this is if you've ever been out to dinner and seen a couple at a table sitting with each other, both looking at their phones. And we laugh at that and go, oh, but like that is a perfect picture of what's going on all the time. They're right there in a real relationship. They are right there to have a conversation. And what are they both doing? They are both engaging with other relationships. They're choosing what is synthetic and unfulfilling over what will actually give life. And so her solution, or at least one of the things that she said in here, is I made the choice to live inside of my reality. I made the choice to spend my time collecting inside treats. And I love the wording of that, the choose to live inside of my reality. Because I think one of the beautiful things is our actual reality is very limited. Right? God created us in these bodies limited. We can only go so many places. You can only empathize about so many things that you're actually connected with. You can only be sure of so much. And there's something very human about the limitations that God designed into us. But what smartphones do is they give you this magical little device that dulls us to our limits. And I use that term magic. That's the term that Andy Crouch actually uses in his book, The TechWise Family. And this is how he describes, he says, for almost all of human history, tools were quite limited. They weren't everywhere. They were in specific places. Tools were in the field, agricultural tools, or in the kitchen, cooking tools, or in the tool shed, work tools. And while tools helped us to do our work, they didn't work on their own. The dream of a tool that would work by itself was strictly the stuff of magic or fantasy. The sorcerer's apprentice dream of a broom that would clean by itself. And so he goes on to say that what we have been given is something that appears to just kind of work on its own. It appears to have no limits, and in that, it seems that it makes us no longer limited. Technology allows us to do things that once seemed impossible, some things that even seem impossible now. It allows us to then imagine a benefit that is beyond our limitations. And so we give our phones and our apps a sense of hope and dedication that they will never be able to meet. And we begin to think that because they can accomplish things that we had never imagined, that they might hold the answer to everything. And so that's where she goes on to say, we have been trained to go to our phones for all of our problems. Now, the truth is, if you step back from media for just a second, it doesn't take that long to actually look at it and go, no, that's not going to solve all of our problems. The problem is, we don't step back from it for a moment to actually see that. That's one of the tricks that it plays, is it distracts us. It keeps us engaged. It makes us believe that our problems don't actually exist because, well, our mind is busy right now. Crouch goes on to say, because technology is devoted primarily to making our lives easier, it discourages us from disciplines, especially the ones that involve disentangling ourselves from technology itself. This reminded me of the somewhat famous quote, no one's going to give you the education you need to overthrow them, if you've ever heard that before. If this is true of people, I would say it's doubly true of technology that is programmed by people and programmed specifically to keep you connected. And the best way to keep you connected to anything is to create the appearance of answers while never actually solving any of your problems. Right, giving you just enough to keep believing that the next thing that it does will give you what you need. Because if your problem ever gets fixed, then you don't need the thing anymore. And if you stop believing that this thing is going to answer your problems, you don't need it anymore. And so it has to do, again, just enough. Just enough to believe that the media will meet your needs so you don't put it down. And so media is built to be a magic that excites our imagination to new possibilities while never actually providing our tangible needs. And in this, it ends up creating a sort of bondage. Because as long as we have needs, we will keep going back to the thing that promises itself as the cure, even if it continues to give us a slow drip of trauma. And so the key to breaking this bondage is first to understand what is going on. How is media affecting us? The second thing is to recognize what is it in us that keeps going back? What is it in us that's actually making it so hard for us to actually do what is healthy? And the third thing is to put together a plan to set healthy boundaries that allow us to control our interaction with media. And so those second two are what we're going to do tomorrow. Tonight we're going to do that first part, recognizing what media is doing. We've done some of that, but I'm going to kind of go into now the five types of media trauma. So this morning when I talked to Jenny and she's like, I'm not coming. And I'm like, oh, wonderful. She said, well, I'll send you an advanced copy of her book that's coming out next month. And so the rest of this is all her words, her ideas. I'm totally just riffing off of it. Some of that was actually me, believe it or not. But she sent me kind of the breakdown of how she has now defined what is actually happening to us. What is the trauma that we're experiencing when we interact with media? And the five types of media trauma she defines are misuse, expectation, development, incident, and addiction. Or media, right? Like any good author. Huh? Media, yeah. All right, so the first one is misuse. Trauma occurring when a misuse of personal media results in neglect of self or others. And then she says misuse is not the same as addiction. There might not be a specific thing on media where you feel like, man, I am stuck on this. I am totally addicted to this. This consumes me. Misuse means overwhelming options, demands, or vulnerabilities causing you to manage your phone longer than you manage your basic needs. In other words, allowing media to use you rather than you using it. We need to know that others can see us and we have an impact on them. There's a primal need that we falsely believe social media can feed. She talked a little bit about teenagers wanting to be seen, wanting to be known. Many teenagers then are harshly judged for sort of their addiction to screens, but we don't really recognize that, you know, many of them have grown up in a world where they didn't get any attention because everyone around them was staring at their phones. They didn't have a lot of the time given to them that we did. In the 1970s, Dr. Ed Tronick led a powerful experiment now called the Still Face Experiment. I don't know if you guys have heard of this. Pretty famous experiment. In the experiment, a mother faces her baby and is asked to hold her face still and not to react to the baby, which is terrible, by the way. That is, I understand it's an experiment, but come on. And so what ends up happening is the mom just sits there and the baby is trying to get a reaction from the parent, and the baby actually gets really agitated. Gets really, really upset that the parent, the mom, will not respond. It says, the single most important thing that your child needs at any stage in their development is your connection, presence, and affection. This experiment showed how strong our need for connection is, and it gives insight into how a parent's reaction can impact the emotional development of a baby. Specifically, this experiment told us what happens when connection does not occur. She goes on to say, over the last decade, we basically have an entire society that is a still face. That is, our society, our culture is not giving the feedback that it's meant to give, the very human connection. This causes people to turn inward or more often to turn to their device. It can be lonely not to have a phone when everyone else does. That's one of the biggest reasons I hear for parents going like, well, my kid needs one because they'll never fit in if they don't have one. Every other kid has one. In fact, what we are doing is we're looking to our devices for connection. But if they're not available, we'll take almost any distraction over being ignored. That is the worst possible thing we can imagine, just simply being invisible. This need for connection remains. It's not just a baby thing. It's not just a teenage thing. We all need this. We all crave this. No matter our age, we need communication and feedback. And so media becomes the place where we go to get a response, to feel like we're noticed and that people care. And so what this term misuse points to is that media takes the place of healthier choices that would provide us with human and holistic fulfillment of our needs. And so rather than an actual compliment, we settle for a positive comment. Rather than affirmation, we seek likes. Rather than being known, we seek followers. And in a sense, we know it's all a game. We point at it all the time and be like, social media is not real. And yet there's this weird pull back to it over and over again. So rather than seeking what is real, we go to get the next quick response. And the trauma of this is that it robs us of these inside treats that we would otherwise be gaining, and it locks us into a dependence on social media. If that's where you are getting all your validation, you will keep going back to it even if it's not actually fulfilling you. Second one is expectations. Media trauma occurring when expectations of school, work, or social circles requires media and technology use that compromises emotional, physical, or mental wellness. This definition of media trauma revealed itself during the global pandemic. More than half of Americans are suffering from screen fatigue due to COVID-19 pandemic, according to research. Survey of 2,000 Americans found 53% of respondents are burnt out on screens over the last few months. If you had any sort of job where you had to do Zoom meetings, you know what this felt like, right? The study showed that before the COVID-19 pandemic, the average American surveyed was getting about 4 hours of screen time per day. Since the quarantine started, that number has jumped up to over 6 hours a day. So we're suffering from eye strain, back pain, neck pain. In addition, we're experiencing physical and mental exhaustion from the demands and pace of virtual life. It's not just about staring at a screen. It's what kind of the technology now requires and demands of us. During the COVID pandemic, then, technology enabled many to shift work and school into a virtual space. But as much as we can do that, it's not healthy for us. And so while our minds are busier than ever, our bodies are missing out on the subtle gifts that real life gives. Eye contact with other humans, and breaks that are effortlessly available to us in person. I'll just say I noticed this a long time ago in what I'll call the last round of technology, before really social media was huge, but I was working in an architecture firm, and I was balancing like a lot of projects. It's like one of those things where I was just kind of like, my brain cannot keep on top of all the projects that I'm working on, and I thought, like, this doesn't seem right. Started to realize, you know, AutoCAD allows us to draft quickly and email allows us to communicate with our clients quickly. And so everything is now expected to be quicker. And so I went back and I did a survey of some of my favorite architects just to see like how many jobs they did a year. I was just interested to see kind of like how, what pace were they working at? And I found that they were doing a little bit less than half of the jobs that we were producing at that time. Now, you hear that and you're like, positive technology. Look how much more you can get done. And there is some positive to that. But the other side of it is when you're managing a project like that, you're having to kind of keep in your mind all of these pieces and parts. You have to measure things against each other. And when the technology goes further than your human limitations, all of a sudden you start making mistakes. All of a sudden your projects are not turning out the way they should because, again, when you're hand drafting and your next meeting isn't until the next week and some of these sorts of things, you actually have the space to catch up to that. And so as technology allowed us to move faster, the expectation rose with it as well, and we couldn't slow down to a more human pace because that's now what was expected. Technology allowed it, so that's what you have to do. And so not only were we kind of pressed to complete the task, and I think the quality went down, the other side of it is everyone was running on high all the time. Everyone was just feeling like, man, it was deadline after deadline after deadline after deadline, and it just builds up this kind of mental fatigue that you can't handle. Now, I will just say, I've seen the same thing in my current vocation. The fact that media keeps us connected all the time means that you are never really away from people. I know lots of pastors who basically, that's one of the most difficult things for them is people can contact me all the time. And even when they're not calling me, the fact that they know that they can contact me all the time is just this stress that exists. But I think I've seen it in a kind of a different place, and that is people's expectation for you to respond to everything that happens all the time, right? So a cultural event happens, Twitter responds, the blogosphere responds, and all of a sudden people are like, okay, what's the church going to say? What's the church's response? And I've had people contact me on things sometimes like, what are you going to say? And I'm like, well, I'm about to turn on the news. I'll let you know. And on the other side of it, I have seen pastors who speak, who feel that, and they respond, and then later on, it's like, you probably should have waited till a little bit more of the news came out because you just put your foot in your mouth. But there's this idea that you need to keep up with it all because you can, that you have to have an opinion on everything because it's there. So I think a lot of times it'd be patience and just kind of going like, we don't have to have a response to everything within 5 seconds. It's okay to sit on stuff. It's okay to not be worried about everything in the moment. But what all this creates is kind of this ever-present burden of expectation. Now, I'm not trying to say that what I am dealing with is bigger than what you are dealing with. That's just what I happen to be able to see because I'm there. I'm sure that you can add your own examples as bosses ask people to take their email with them, you know, when they go on vacation, just in case something comes up. I remember one of our former elders was a VP of sales, and when we were on our elder visioning retreats, he was having to check numbers and respond to things because you weren't allowed to ever really leave. You had to carry that with you everywhere you went. And so the call to act and respond and share just never gives us the space to rest. It never gives us kind of a clear area. And so even when we aren't looking at our phones, the fact that they're there in our house with the ping turned on, it's enough to remind us that these expectations exist, that we need to be ready, that at any moment, if somebody needs us, we better be ready to respond. And again, it doesn't allow us to ever just kind of relax. Now, there's another part of the expectation, and I think that's the expectation that social media builds in ourselves, which is as we're scrolling through all these things and we're seeing everybody else's life, as much as we know it's cultivated, as much as we know it's fake, we still compare ourselves. We end up kind of getting this idea of what our life is supposed to look like in comparison to other people's lives. One time in a sermon, I went after Pinterest, and man, did I hear about that afterwards. But part of that was just saying, like, it creates this, like, perfect idea of what everything is, and then it's kind of like, oh, did your birthday party not match up? I'm sorry, your child's going to be, you know, traumatized for the rest of their life because, you know, you didn't spend 500 hours making the cake. It builds this expectation that you measure yourself against, and all of a sudden, you're actually beating yourself up for something that really doesn't matter at all. You've got a false sense of what that expectation is. The third thing is development. Media trauma occurring when it causes an interruption to a human development due to personal media use. According to Eric Erickson, humans need to master these particular phases of development to thrive and function at any phase. And so he's kind of got a breakdown of the questions that we ask or need to understand about ourselves in different phases of life. From 0 to 2 years old, can I trust the world? From 2 to 4 years old, is it okay to be me? 5 to 8 years old, is it okay for me to do, move, and act? I've never heard a 5 to 8 year old actually ask that question. They usually just do whatever they want. 9 to 12 years old, can I make it in the world? 13 to 19 years old, who am I and who can I be? 19 to 40, can I love? 40 to 60, can I make my life count? 65 plus, is it okay to have been me? And basically says here, these are essential questions for our essential selves. And our self-esteem is built on opportunities to explore these things within ourselves, to kind of find answers to these questions. It's important to note that we develop psychological issues when we cannot master these questions, when we don't actually find answers to these things. And right now, most of our culture is developing their sense of self from social media engagement in at least equal parts to the world. She said in the video, most of us are allowing media to influence us more than the humans in our lives. And so we're going to a synthetic source to answer our deep questions of meaning. And it's important to note that this is more than just a sociological or a psychological issue. We need to step back and recognize God created us for community. Not just so that we wouldn't be lonely, but our place in community helps define for us who we are and where we belong. And so our place in the family and in the church and the workplace and in relation to the place that we exist in, these provide for us a framework for answering these questions. It helps us to know who we are and where we fit. And what media does is it disembodies this. It makes these questions nothing more than ideological questions. Right? We get answers to these questions that are not coming from people who know us, not coming from people who love us, but from the kind of a disconnected place, from just, again, disconnected facts. And so rather than these questions being a journey that we're on with other people, they become an individual search, and our development is limited to what we already possess. Right? We are then only going to be what we already are, unless we're inviting other people in. And I would say this is why the last few years we've seen people consume media that matches what they already believe. They're not being formed, they're not growing, they're basically going and looking to confirm what they already think. But real human contact allows us to grow and adapt. Interacting with facts alone tends to make us more rigid in our thinking. Right? People change us. Facts actually usually don't. So it's important that we're actually interacting with others for our development, not just going to disembodied sources. Number 4 is incident. This is media trauma that occurs when a human experiences or witnesses a traumatic incident through personal media use. She says, think of the all too common story of the young girl whose ex-boyfriend sends naked pictures of her to the entire football team. In this, then, media becomes the means by which the traumatic incident occurs. And then there's the old saying, the internet never forgets, and we've seen that proven over the last couple of years. It's really been interesting. There's a lot of people who are kind of drafted into sports, so they've just become kind of a professional, just gotten the big spotlight, and all of a sudden somebody will do a deep dive to some tweet that they made when they were 10 or 12, and basically brings it out, and are like, what a bigot, and all of a sudden, this is happening all the time. Once those things are out there, you can't ever get them back. And that's part of what is actually terrifying about them, is you can't do anything to fix it. Right? Once something becomes viral, it takes on a life of its own. Being publicly shamed and losing one's place in society becomes this emotionally traumatic event that kind of cuts at who we are and how we understand ourselves as a fit. For those who struggle with their place, right, think the bullied kid at school, media becomes a way for this trauma to live on beyond just the school day. Right, it used to be that you went to school, you dreaded going to school, you got beat up, but then the school day ended and you went home. Now it's, if your life is entirely on social media, all of that follows you home, right? You're a loser at home too. And it just is there all the time reminding you that you aren't who you want to be. Incident trauma is often the negative, I think, effects that we think of on social media. Usually when we're like, what can social media do to us? We think about kind of some of these negative things that could happen. Again, naked pictures that could be shared, videos, these sorts of things. But there's another form that's a bit harder to make sense of, and Jenny mentioned in her video of this vicarious trauma. I think that's kind of an amazing concept. It doesn't make sense. When she said it the first time, I was like, that can't be right. So I actually searched that study because I was like, that just seems fake. Right? This is the reaction to witnessing or experiencing a traumatic event happening to another person. It can be triggered by watching, reading, listening to, or an indirect experience of the traumatizing situation. And as she said, it can often be more difficult to process than the actual event itself. One of the main issues with incident trauma, whether it's firsthand experience or vicarious, is that it tends to create this feeling of being trapped. I already said this. Once an embarrassing video is out there, you can't do anything to fix it. Once you watch the video of George Floyd, you experience this deep desire for justice, but then you go, what do I do? I don't live anywhere near Minneapolis. So I can join the social media response, and that's kind of a way to kind of get it out. But in a sense, that's what's so difficult about it, is you can't release this. You've let it in, but you can't let it out. So you're filled with all the traumatic energy without a means of release, and many people then, it leads them to unhealthy way of dealing with all of that that they're carrying, including suicide, drug use, cutting, a lot of the things that people are going, it's just this, I need a way to kind of get rid of what I'm feeling. It's an attempt to do something, anything, to deal with the built-up trauma. Which brings us to the fifth one, which is addiction. Media trauma occurring when a person suffers from an addiction to their phone, media, or other screens. Simple definition of addiction is any behavior that impairs our relationships, work, or play. This can blur quickly because many of us have relationships that exist mostly online. Many do work online, do school online. It's all too easy to replace genuine play, genuine life with consuming content. Our screens are absorbing and give us immediate feedback. Now, like addiction, workaholism, all these things existed well before the internet ever came around. Obsessive tendencies, television, video game addictions, as we started out, like these things have been around, they're not new. But when we satisfy one need at an intense level, it is human nature to become overly focused on that one area. And in overly focusing on that one area, the other areas of our life suffer, right? When we become addicted to our media, other aspects of our life are now getting lost. And so what's new in this technology over others, as I said at the beginning, is that the designs of our phones and the algorithms underscoring social media and video games are there to keep us connected. It's there to play off of the dopamine fix. It's there to give us something that makes us keep coming back. They're created to do that. The IT and or the AI that's used in there, I'm just going to say this, it's smarter than you. I know. This is one of the things is people think, oh, no, I can handle it. You can't. The whole system, it's like the gambler who goes into the casino is like, no, I'm smarter than the house. It's like, no, it's set up to beat you. It's set up to beat you. And if you don't know that going in, you're going to have an unhealthy relationship with it. You have to understand these things aren't there to serve you. You know, there's the old saying, if you don't know what the product is, you're the product. It's that whole idea of then anything that's being given out for free on the internet, that means that it is somehow taking something from you. You are the product. And so again, this isn't to strike fear into everyone, but just to say we need to be wise. We need to be discerning. We need to recognize what it is that we're engaging with. We need to recognize how it's affecting us. Our phones have become easy buttons for surface-level experiences that feel like we've done something without actually accomplishing anything. And so we have to ask, what is the cost? Because when you're actually doing it, it seems so simple, it seems so innocent, but we can look around and see the societal impact, we can see all of the brokenness, we can see what it's doing. So you all get to decide how you're going to respond, but don't say you didn't know.